It's rolling.
It's rolling now?
Yep.
Okay.
Any more problems?
Yes.
Oh, oh no.
Yeah, well, it's fantastic. Which state is that?
You mean that the Saturday you need to follow Thanksgiving, the Thursday of Thanksgiving?
Somebody just asked me that. My dad would be too. I suspect I will. I have to see. Why not? Is the building open?
Okay.
Yeah, I would be inclined to. Yes. At this point, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
This is trouble.
Technical difficulties. The battery went dead. I noticed it at about 20 up. Now, look, the people who are listening on the podcast, you see, if we did the simulcast, would this ever have happened, right? The people listening on the podcast, the reason that you are perhaps think you're missing something is that you are. At least 20 minutes of the second hour that I'm aware of, we're going to piece together what you're missing, and an accommodation will be made for you. I'll figure that out. Of all days, for that. We will deal with it, and an accommodation will be made.
I always like to say, no matter what mistake anybody makes in general marketing, you can always fix it. It's always something that can be done. No matter how serious or how awful mistake somebody thinks they made, there's always a way to undo it or to remedy it or to fix it itself. And I suspect this is no different. But,
I'm
The significant aspects of this, you've got, of course, your financial information, confidentiality issues, and the financial aspect, what you're looking for is evidence of a claim and ability to pay. That claim and ability to pay is distinguished from a desire not to pay, or an unwillingness, if you will, to pay. The claim and ability to pay must be satisfied only by evidence of the employer being incapable of paying, having insufficient assets to meet the financial proposals of the union. Okay? There are no magic words that do this, but whatever they are, and they are assessed case by case, they need to show not merely an unwillingness to pay, but an inability to pay. If that inability to pay is met, and when the union asks for financial data to justify the claim of inability to pay, the employer must furnish it. If it's merely an unwillingness to pay, and the union wants the financial data, the employer is under no obligation to give it. In the confidentiality aspect, that area, where you get the issue is, the employer has asserted confidentiality, but that's not the end of the inquiry. What can the union do? The union can ask the employer to bargain over an accommodation to accommodate the employer's confidentiality concern. The employer at that point must bargain. We have been unable really to identify the parameters of that kind of bargaining, and the cases are silent about it. However, understand that the employer can't boldly assert confidentiality and refuse to discuss an accommodation. Okay? Now you get into insurance agents. Great case. Highlights a very important component of labor law. We talked about partial strike. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we were speaking before about how the union companies have all the benefits they can get the employers.
Yeah.
They
yes.
Have the financial data too about the.
Well, but you see, in the financial data situation, the relevance is dictated by the claim of inability to pay. Okay? Once the claim of inability to pay comes up and the union asks for financial data, yeah, I mean, if they ask for financial information from 1971 through present, they'll have to demonstrate why information from 71 until 2008 is relevant, for sure. What would that have anything to do with the employer's claim of inability to pay now, assuming you had a claim of inability to pay, right? The relevance would still need to be demonstrated, communicated to the employer as well as to the NLRB. That would not be presumptively relevant at all, I don't think. But ordinarily it won't come up. I haven't seen that issue come up, quite frankly. When the claim of inability to pay arises, the union is asking for financial data to justify that claim. Clearly, the union is going to be asking for financial documents, financials, if you will, P&L, product and loss statements, from the relevant time period. They're not going to be interested in prior time periods. You know, there's an old saying, be careful what you ask for. Imagine if you asked for all that and the employer gave it to you. What good would it be? What would you use it for? What you're trying to do as the union is, yes, test the veracity of the employer's assertion at the table. Because if it's not true, or now you get these financial pieces of information, and you look at them and you think, this guy's pulling my leg. I don't really think that she doesn't have the money here. This doesn't show that. Now, you as the union can say, well, first of all, you know, I looked at this. Can you explain how you mean that this somehow makes you unable to pay? I'm not really grasping that. Explain it to me, right? Or, more often than not, it's not a bold-faced lie the employer is telling, there's going to be a different opinion on what this financial data really shows. And, as pointed out earlier, it may be relevant to the third year of the contract being bargained. In other words, employer is saying, I can't handle the 4% in the third year. Maybe the union's actuary will be able to say, we looked at this and we think you can, because if you look here, there's a trend in this document that shows that business is actually looking up. You know, maybe if you shifted your cost around a little bit, instead of spending however much on advertising and marketing, which has not really returned much in sales, if you channeled it and spent less and did a public relations campaign, you get more out of it, and you can earmark the rest of that money to the wages within the healthcare. The union's allowed to do that. That's the idea. The union wants to come up with creative ways for the employer to be able to meet the proposal. Now, the employer's not obligated to do that, but in the real world, couldn't you imagine a scenario where the employer hadn't really thought of that, hadn't really entertained that idea, and said, you know, they're right. Maybe I could do that. I hadn't really thought about doing it that way, but it's not a bad idea. Maybe I should do it that way. We never would have gotten there if that financial information had not been produced. Ever. We never would have seen that, right? Believe it or not, you could help. What an outrageous and outlandish idea. It does happen, okay? So that's underlying what they're looking for. I've never seen a case where they asked for, you know, financial data that wouldn't be pertinent to the claim of inability to pay. It's always, the struggle is always, I didn't claim an inability to pay. Well, yes, you did. Did the words rise to that level or didn't they? We never fight about over the actual financial data disclosed. Haven't seen it. It would be unusual. Anybody else? Okay. Insurance agents. This is on 420. And you remember we talked about partial strikes. I went through it early in the semester. Anybody remember it? Remember what a partial strike is? Yes, Sarah.
When they either stop working as much. Was that it? Like, it was when they had the piecemeal plan, and they started working less.
Well, working less is one way to say it. There are other ways. Yeah.
They start doing things against what they're supposed to do in the whole job, like what we talked about, not cleaning the toilet every day. Or
well, okay, yeah, we did talk about not cleaning the cleaning steps, not cleaning the toilets, right? That was the hypothetical idea. Yeah.
If they're taking the amount of time to do
it. It could be. It could be. More often than not, it's selectively deciding what to do and what not to do. The more common example is cleaning staff that is assigned to clean the toilets, clean the windows, sweep the floors, and vacuum the office. They decide conservatively that for 2 days they're not going to clean the toilets. They do everything else, but they don't clean the toilets. Okay? The board finds that type of conduct unprotected.
unprotected. What does that mean? That means that the employees do it, and the employer says, you're fired. They say, wait a minute, we did it together. Remember concerted? Right? We got together and decided to do this, put pressure on the employer because he won't give it the bargaining table, right? But remember what I told you. Concerted, yes, but unprotected. Go back to the part of your outline that talks about unprotected concerted activities. We talked about that again. That's unprotected. Okay? Unprotected means I'm the employer, you're fired. When you go to the labor board and file a charge alleging that the employer fired you for engaging in concerted activities for mutual labor protection, yes, the NLRB will find you engaged in concerted activities, but it wasn't for mutual labor protection. It lost its protection. It lost its protection because it was a partial strike. Now, why do we think a partial strike is unprotected? Why would that be? A full strike? Look at Section 13 of the Act, in Section 7. We walked out on strike. You know nothing else other than the employees walked out on strike. In furtherance of bargaining demands. There's no contract in effect. They struck. I'm here to tell you the employer cannot fire employees for doing that. You know an economic strike that can be permanently replaced. We went over that. Right? We talked about rights of reinstatement for the first jobs available. I went through that. An unfair labor practice strike, only temporary replacements. Remember? Why is a partial strike not protected? Yeah.
Because the employer doesn't know about it, so there's nothing he could do to either fix the situation or prevent them from doing it.
Well, he knows about it once they're doing it.
Right.
But that's more of a notice issue.
Passive aggressive. Yeah.
Well, that's true. I guess they're getting paid. You know, in the strike context, the payment would stop, right, Sean?
The whole idea of the act is more industrial peace and stability. A partial strike is not something that goes towards that.
That's part of it, yeah.
You can replace workers that are still working even if they're not working to full capacity. So it's more difficult to know.
Yeah, you can't really replace them. They're there. So you lose that economic weapon. Yeah?
The union has a majority is going to decide if they're not deciding to do this. If they would decide to do this as a whole, they would just go on strike.
Let's say the union went behind. And the union said, okay, guys, here's what we're going to do. Okay? You're going to not clean the toilets for 2 days. Now the union's behind. Does that change it?
Absolutely.
I don't think so. Yeah.
The employer can't speed up workers. He can't change the terms and conditions of the agreement, but they can slow down to their challenges.
Now you're running. You see, we said earlier, I erased it. The employer can't unilaterally do anything regarding terms and conditions of employment, these mandatory subjects we're about to get into, without bargaining with the union first. Why should we sanction the employees unilaterally deciding what they're going to do vis-a-vis the assignments they've been given? What's good for one is good for the other. Remember the balance we're trying to strike here? Right? That's really the core. That's really the key of it. Okay? It's this notion that we don't want to sanction unilateral conduct by either side. Right? So, what you get here in the insurance agent's case is something very interesting. Look at the tactics that come up in this case. They're on 421, and the issue is, has the union committed a violation of Section 8B3? Reach their duty to bargain in good faith, right? They're dealing with the employer, they're bargaining over a contract, and both are trying to reach an agreement. There's no service bargaining here or anything like that. It's not an A1 king size sandwich situation, right? They're just really not, they're not getting anywhere. So the union decides, we're going to do something about this. And they engage in tactics, right? And having engaged in these tactics that are outlined and set forth at page 421 of the first paragraph, the employer files an unfair labor practice charge. Now, I did tell you that to engage in the partial strike,
is unprotected. But did I ever say it was illegal? I told you the employer could fire these people, right? But I never told you that he could file an unfair labor practice charge on it. That's the issue for the court and insurance companies. Listen to these tactics. This is what they did. They refused for a time, this is the employees, that is, with the union sanctions. And by the way, the union sanctions it, the employees are binding the unions. The union is bound to the conduct, okay? Similarly, a supervisor does something, makes a threat, fires somebody. That's the employer acting. Don't be confused by the fact that the supervisor does it. The supervisor is an agent of the employer, assuming he or she is a supervisor. If that's what, you know, there's no dispute that they're a supervisor, then they are the employer. And that's what's going on here. Here the employees are binding the union. Okay? What do? Refuse for a time to solicit new business, right? And they refuse, after the writing of the new business was resumed, to comply with the company's reporting procedures. They refuse to participate in the company's May Policyholders Month campaign. They reported late to district offices the day the agents were scheduled to attend them, and refused to perform customary duties at the offices, instead engaging there in sit-in mornings, doing what comes naturally, leaving it known as a group, absenting themselves from special business conferences arranged by the company. They picketed and distributed leaflets outside the office. That's not really a partial strike. But they did it at hours directed by the union, so it's not clear when they did it. They distributed leaflets each day. That's not a partial strike either, okay? But they did solicit policyholder signatures on petitions directed to the company. So they're going to the company's customers and asking the customers to sign petitions, right? And presented the signed policyholder petitions to the company at its home office while simultaneously engaging in mass demonstrations. Okay, some of this stuff constitutes partial strike activity and some doesn't, but a lot of it does. And the question for the court is this an unfair labor practice? Unprotected, yes. An unfair labor practice, no. Now, you might think this is an insignificant distinction, since what's the remedy? Let's assume for a minute that the court found that it was an unfair labor practice. Let's just take it as a gift. They filed a charge, and let's say the court agreed with them. Okay, you sold me. I'm the Justice Brennan, and I think it is illegal. It's an unfair labor practice. What does the employer get? Well, he gets to put a note on the wall in which the union says, I agree I won't do these things, or otherwise log in their opinion. Somewhat significant, I guess, but it's all it is a notice of the union agreeing that they won't do this stuff anymore. The employer, irrespective of whether there was an unfair labor practice committed on these facts or not, if it's a partial strike, as I told you it is, always had the right to just fire these folks, okay? They don't need an unfair labor practice finding to fire them. All it needs to be is unprotected. There's no dispute. The court is not taking issue with the fact that it's unprotected. It is unprotected, okay? The question is it an unfair labor practice? And the court finds that it's not. It doesn't violate the duty to bargain in good faith. What it does not do is give the employer cause for a National Labor Relations Board remedy. The posting of that notice where the union commits or promises not to do these things again. And there is some significance to that beyond the posting of the notice. From a procedural standpoint, if the board issues an order that says, you know, union, you have to agree not to do these things again, right? And now there's an order and the union does them again, well, the board can petition for court enforcement of that order, right? If the court enforces the order and the union keeps doing it, it's called contempt. Money, fines, right? So it's something more significant than you might otherwise expect. The employer doesn't have that option here. Think about it. Maybe you're an employer, you don't want to fire these employees. Maybe they're skilled employees, you can't find anyone else to do this stuff, and that's not an option for you. Many industries like that. Take the sign hanging industry. You ever see those Has anybody ever come out of the LIE, out of the Midtown Tunnel, onto the LIE? When you drive out of the Midtown Tunnel eastbound toward Long Island, there are billboards everywhere. I mean, you can't miss these billboards. And at Times Square, there are electronic billboards. There are a limited universe of employees who hang those billboards and maintain them. You can't just be some joker on the street and get that job. Heaven forbid if you did, and you went up there, you'd fall down and die, okay? It wouldn't work. You can't just go up there. It's not that easy. It's a skilled job. These guys take their lives in their hands. And if they didn't have the skill to do it, believe me, they'd fall down and they would be dead. I had a case in the industry and I know it intricately. What if it's an industry like that? They engage in the unprotected conduct. Oh, we'll just fire them. Yeah, that's easy for you to say. I can't fire them. There's nobody else who can do this. What am I going to do? Go out of business? Here, now what's he going to do? Now you know why he spent all that money on Jack Lewis to file his discharge and the argument from the Supreme Court, right? If you talked to Matthew Camardello, I didn't even know that. He forgot it. Because I'm a podcast, too. Now you can go on the website. Yes. I love it. Okay. But you get the idea. The distinction is not so insignificant as you might think. It's not easy to just fire people. But ULP versus unprotected. Remember. Okay? Important. We get into NLRB v. Katz, right? Page 427. Sorry if I'm flying along here a little bit, but I do want to get into a little bit of what I was going to go into next week to give us enough time to have a review session. Katz is a very interesting case. Out of Katz is a doctrine, okay? I gave it to you, I don't know, about an hour and a half ago, maybe more, 6:30 or so. We talked about unilateral action, right? I think I said something on the order of, a per se violation of the duty to bargain in good faith is when the employer makes unilateral changes to terms and conditions of employment during negotiations without having reached a good faith interface, right? Anybody read that? Yeah, I'm sorry.
Where is it from? It seemed like you were reading it, so I wanted to.
It's from my head. Well, it's my head that was transferred from my head onto the page that I wrote.
I found the reading.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to give you the page of my notes. That would be too easy for everyone. Per se violation of the duty to bargain in good faith for the employer to make unilateral changes to terms and conditions of employment during negotiations without having reached a good faith interface. Oh, yeah. Did anybody read Katz? You guys did. I know you all love these cases where they say, we hold that, right? Everybody looks for that. We hold that. And you pink highlight, right? Make sure we get that one done. That's the whole thing, right? Find me the part of Katz that says what I just said. Yeah? You found it? Oh, yeah? Okay. Where is it?
It's on 428. It's the third full paragraph of what I said.
428.
Third full paragraph.
Third full paragraph. What does it say?
Says we hold that an employer is not allowed to change the conditions of employment under negotiations similarly a violation of 885 or its circumvention of the duty to negotiate which frustrates the objectives of 885 as much as it does the flat.
Yeah. There's only one problem with all this. Okay? Now, it's probably about the sixth time I'm going to say it. Does it say that unilateral changes to terms and conditions of employment during negotiations without having reached a good faith impasse is illegal? Does it say that there?
No.
No. It doesn't say that. What it says is, where an employer makes unilateral changes to
conditions of employment under negotiation is a violation because it's a circumvention of the duty to negotiate. Same thing about the past year there? It mentions good faith negotiation, but it says nothing about impasse, right? Is there anything about impasse anywhere in here?
Well, somewhere in here it does, but it doesn't say what I said.
Look at 429. Bottom of the first full paragraph. The first paragraph says other considerations. It's the, on 429 at the bottom. The last sentence. But even after an impasse is reached, he, meaning the employer, has no license to grant wage increases greater than any he has ever offered the union at the bargaining table, for such action is necessarily inconsistent with the sincere desire to conclude an agreement with the union. So in this case, they granted wage increases different than what they had offered the union at the table, right? Evan, you mentioned that they actually gave wage increases in this case earlier.
Did they give more than was the average, too? So
it's real nice, right? What do I need the union for if the employer is going to give me a wage increase? I don't need the union, right? Well, but you see, that's the only place where I see impasse, right, written. Then, if you get to 430, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, about the 12th line down, it says, unilateral action by an employer without prior discussion with the union does amount to a refusal to negotiate about the effective conditions of employment under negotiation and must of necessity obstruct bargaining contrary to congressional policy. It will often disclose an unwillingness to agree with the union. It will rarely be justified by any reason of substance. It follows the board may hold that such unilateral action should be an unfair labor practice, violation of 885, without also finding the employer guilty of overall subjective bad faith. Last sentence. While we do not foreclose the possibility that there might be circumstances which the board could or should accept as excusing or justifying unilateral action, no such case is presented here. Well, I can tell you that there are circumstances where the employer can show extreme financial exigency, extreme financial circumstances like they're bankrupt, there's nothing in the bank, where they can take unilateral action, but those really are few and far between. More often than not, what comes up is the rule that I enunciated to you, which doesn't say that in this case. Okay? There's nowhere it says the rule that I set forth. Yet this case, since it was decided in 1962, stands for the very proposition that I verbalized to you no less than six times. It's called the impasse rule. What it's referred to as. Yet, nowhere in the case does it say it. But it's implicit. Okay? The sentence on 429, even after an impasse is reached, you can't grant a wage increase different than what you offered at the table, leaves open the prospect that, well, maybe if you offered the wage increase that you offered at the table, after an impasse, it might be okay. Right? And similarly, they refuse at the end to say, we don't foreclose the possibility there might be circumstances where the board could accept or excuse unilateral action, right? Over the years, good faith impasse will permit the employer to engage in unilateral action, okay? But that's where negotiations are in progress, right? The impasse rule comes up where employer and union are bargaining. They are actively negotiating for a contract, whether it's for a new contract to succeed one that has expired, or whether it is an initial bargain, right? We're starting negotiations, right? We're bargaining, employer and union, and we're not getting anywhere, right? It's going on, and the employer is bargaining in good faith. She's trying to reach an agreement. She's doing all she can, but we're just not getting there. I mean, if the union wants X and I want Y, we're going back and forth. There comes a point where the board and the law finds that good faith negotiations have been exhausted and it hasn't worked. That point is called an impasse. And where a good faith impasse has been reached,
At that point, the employer may take unilateral action.
But only consistent with text, meaning
she can only implement the last offer she made at the table.
What this has evolved into
is the employer says to the union, okay, I'm making my last and final offer. This is it. I believe we're in an impasse. Either take this or leave. But that's all I'm going to do.
Query. How do we know we're at an impasse? That's for collective bargaining. That's for the collective bargaining, of course. Okay? There's a case called Taft that sets forth a variety of criteria that the board uses to measure whether or not the parties are at an impasse. But I'm not going to get into that. It's a highly fact-sensitive inquiry that is dependent on a number of things. More significantly is the need for the requisite presence of good faith. Okay. The employer is committing some violation during the negotiation process. Refusing to furnish relevant information, maybe, and says, we're an impasse. Here's my last and final offer. Take it or leave it. The union says, sorry. And the employer implements it. You may have reached an impasse, yes, but it wasn't a good faith impasse because you haven't met your duty to bargain in good faith because you didn't give the information they wanted, if it was assuming it was relevant, and they were entitled to it. Needs to be a good faith impasse. Even more significantly, remember the context, okay? The impasse rule for the employer, which licenses the employer to take unilateral action, it's limited to when negotiations are in progress, okay? And what I said was, we're bargaining, right? That's basically the impasse rule. Of course, the employer has to declare impasse. They always do. But there needs to be good faith, you need to be at the impasse, and you can only implement your last and final law. But what about another situation? What if negotiations are not in progress? During the term of the contract, we'll see, probably not until next week, that there are certain things that you have to bargain about during the term of the contract if they haven't been discussed and they're not contained in the contract. Right? Let's say the employer tells the union about one of those subjects, lets them know, listen, I'm going to implement a new safety requirement for the bargaining unit personnel. Write them a letter. All right. The union is asleep at the wheel. Negotiations are not in progress in this context. Okay. The union gets the letter, telling them that listen, you know, I'd like to do this, and I'm letting you know that I want to do this. Please respond and let me know what you think. The union, because they're not policing the contract, they're asleep at the wheel, they don't respond. The employer doesn't. The union says, wait a minute, you didn't reach a good faith impasse with me. Guess what? The employer doesn't have to reach a good faith impasse with you. When negotiations are not in progress, all the employer needs to do is give the union notice and an opportunity to bargain. Notice,
and an opportunity to move. These are two different contexts. Negotiations in progress, negotiations not in progress. Now, you'll see, and I think we'll probably get to it in the first hour of next week, that in a situation like this, there's going to be a distinction between terms that are contained in the collective bargaining agreement. That would be the only real situation where negotiations are not in progress, okay? If there's already an agreement there. Even if there's no agreement, it's initial bargaining and, I don't know, there have been 2 months or 3 months between negotiations, they're still in progress, okay? That's not going to be what dictates it. It's going to be the presence of the contract or not. Negotiations are in progress with no contract. If there's a contract there, then they're not in progress. But usually the way this is going to come up is something that's not contained in the contract, and the employer wants to do it. Got to tell the union, give them an opportunity to bargain. No need to reach an impasse. Okay. I want to spend the last 20 minutes talking about the subject of collective bargaining.
You'll see that in the syllabus, this is really the last class that comes up on the subject of collective bargaining, mandatory versus permissive, and a number of other issues I have listed there. We probably won't get to success issue, but I'm going to that. You know, it's a little bit too far afield. And quite frankly, I would have liked to, but it's probably not enough time. We've been talking about wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment. Remember, the impasse rule I talked to you about, unilateral changes in terms and conditions of employment. Well, the question becomes, what do I mean by that? We said wages, right? Hours. What are the shifts that employees have to work, right? Terms and conditions of employment. Health care, safety, pension. All many different things. Arbitration is no strike. Management rights clause, like the one that came up in A1 king size sandwiches. Union security clause is a term and condition of employment. It's a mandatory subject of bargaining. All these things come under the banner of something called mandatory subject of bargaining. Okay? By mandatory, look it up in the dictionary, it means that the employer has to bargain about them, right? However, and that's most subjects, most, but not all. There are other topics that come up in negotiations that are not mandatory. They are called permissive. The third category called the illegal subjects of bargaining. I really don't want to get into that. It's very unusual that the parties would discuss something that's not illegal. You don't really have to go there. The big distinction is mandatory and permissive. Well, you know what mandatory is, so let's try to outline some permissive subjects. Very common, what comes up is the parties are going to sit down and bargain a contract. Right? And one side says, look, I'd like to have a court reporter here to take the negotiations. The other side says, I don't want to be taped. Doesn't matter which side is saying they don't want to be taped. Sometimes the union doesn't want to be taped, sometimes the employer doesn't want to be taped. It's really happening. I don't want to be taped, I don't want a court reporter. The other side wants it, says, well, I'm not doing this without a court reporter. I'm not going to bother you. You either have a court reporter or I'm going home. The court reporter taping the negotiations is a permissive subject of bargaining. Parties are not required to bargain about a permissive subject. They can if they want. Okay? There's nothing illegal about doing it. You know,
You could if you want to, and maybe the parties will talk about, look, I'll let you take the negotiations if you give on the arbitration clause and limit it to certain things.
All right, maybe I'll do that.
Or I'll take the negotiations if you agree to do them all in my office instead of having to do it at a hotel. Very often parties want to do it at a hotel and it costs, right? They can accommodate themselves that way, and that would be fine. But you see, what the party proposing the court reporter can't do is condition further bargaining on it. She can't insist to impasse. Impasse is, we're not getting anywhere, right? We just went through that. Insist to impasse is another way to say conditioning bargaining. And there are plenty of permissive subjects. You should know how to spot them. Probably the most common that comes up are internal union funds. Seen this time and again. And we had one that came up in a case several years ago. The case is called Quality House of Graphics. Yeah?
What was that again?
What was what?
Permissive
subject?
Yeah,
internal union funds. F-U-N-D-S. What do I mean by that? I'm going to give you an example. In a case called Quality House of Graphics, the union had something called the Interlocal Pension Fund. This was a fund that the union created that union members paid into voluntarily on their own. The employer was not required to contribute anything to it, and it had nothing to do with the employer. It wasn't in the contract, it wasn't a term or condition of employment, it was a perk that the union gave the members. Wrong with this? You know, if you're a union member and you contribute X amount to this interlocal pension fund, then at the end of the, you know, when it's time to retire, it's an extra pot of money for you. You know? It's like a lot of unions have credit unions, you know, where you can put money in and take it out at your leisure or within certain restrictions. It's nothing to do with the employer. The employer is not making any contributions to it. The employer doesn't even know, isn't supposed to know what it is. You know, it's for union members. The employer in that case said, no. Whoa, I don't want you to have that. And conditioned bargaining on the union modifying the fund requirements or something bizarre like that. I don't remember the exact fact of the case. The interlocal pension fund that had nothing to do with the employer was a permissive subject to bargaining. And when the employer conditioned further bargaining on the union doing something to that interlocal pension fund, the employer violated the act, insisting to impasse on a permissive subject or conditioning further bargaining on a permissive subject. Do not be confused with a pension fund that the union is asking the employer to contribute to. That's a mandatory subject. Listen, I'm the employer, it's my money. You're asking me to give it to your pension fund so at the end of the employee's lifetime of work, there'll be a retirement package for them, a pension for them to draw upon. If I have to give money into it, that sure as heck is a mandatory subject to bargaining. The union has to bargain about that, isn't it? Of course they do. This pension fund has nothing to do with the employer. The case that you're assigned for next week, and I know you haven't read it yet, you should read, is Borg 1 on 452. The permissive subjects there are an internal ballot provision that required a vote by the union before going on strike. Okay? What does this internal union vote on going on strike have to do with the employer? Now, yeah, it might affect the employer's operation, but it's a very private matter. The employer can't sit in on the strike vote. She has no say on how to use the strike to go on strike. I mean, if there's no strike clause in the contract and it's the middle of the contract, the union couldn't go on strike unless it was under the labor practice strike. That's not what's at issue here. It's the actual employees secretly voting to go on strike or not. The employer, in that case, tried to stick its nose in there and made a proposal, but it wouldn't back off. It conditioned further bargaining on that. No good. The other issue in that case was a recognition clause. The NLRB actually certified I believe it was the international union in that case, but the local union was really doing all the bargaining. the employer insisted that the recognition clause had the local union and not the international union there. I think they thought about that. That's not really a myth. That's not really a term or condition of anybody's employment. It's the name of the party doing the bargaining. That's not germane to the collective bargaining process. It's a permissive subject. Listen, the parties could bargain over it if they chose. It'd be okay, but they're not required to. Okay? There's a line of other subjects that draw the line between mandatory and permissive. We'll go through a few now before we finish up. Next week, assigned case, American National Insurance, talks about a management rights clause. You remember the management rights clause? It was this draconian thing in A1 king-size sandwiches. Well, management rights clauses alone are not illegal to insist on them. You know, employers discuss them all the time. And in American National Insurance on 447, they call it a management functions clause. Okay? And this one is a garden variety, a typical one on 448. The right to select, to hire, demote, to a better position, discharge, demote, or discipline for cause. Notice the for cause language there. And to maintain discipline and efficiency of employees and to determine schedules of work is recognized by both the union and the company as the proper responsibility and prerogative of management to be held and exercised by the company. And while it's agreed that an employee feeling himself to have been aggrieved by any decision of the company in respect to such matters, or the union in his behalf has the right to have the decision reviewed by top management or the company under the grievance regime. It's reserving traditional management functions to management, of course, subject to the grievance procedure. The union could grieve about it. It could presumably arbitrate about it as an arbitration clause in the contract. Okay. Management rights clause. This case deems that a mandatory subject of bargaining. Okay? It means that if the employer is at loggerheads with the union and says, look, I've got to have my management rights clause here, but you're not going to have an agreement. I'm going to be at impasse on that with you. Without that, I cannot have an agreement. That's okay. That's legal. It's okay to be intransigent on certain things, provided it doesn't manifest evidence that shows you don't want to really reach an agreement. You want your proposal, yes. How far can you go is another question. Here, the only issue with the management rights clause, and it's a reasonable one, the employer can insist on impasse to that. Why? It's a mandatory subject. As opposed to the court reporter or the interlocal pension fund, which are permissive subjects of bargaining. That's the distinction. Very often, another one that comes up that's permissive is the scope of the bargaining. Parties agreed either voluntarily or under an NLRB certification that was issued to a unit of production and maintenance employees. And we get to bargaining, and the employer says, you know, I really want the drivers in the unit, okay? I want to expand it to include the drivers. And the union says, you know, those guys are a bunch of whatever. They didn't support me. I was successful at the labor board, they carved them out and they directed an election and just production and maintenance. I don't want the drivers. The employer says, either the drivers are in or I'm not bargaining. That's permissive. The scope of the bargaining unit is permissive. The employer can't condition further bargaining on the union capitulating to that proposal. Okay? You start to get a feel for this when you see the types of things that are permissive and that are mandatory. For instance, after the Thorne Warner case, 458 talks about the mandatory permissive distinction, and at 460 and 461, they give you, well, in 462, they give you a couple of cases. Let's go through that now a little bit. In a case called Chicago Stamping Plant, at issue was the price of food in the cafeteria. Well, it's the employer's cafeteria, but apparently it was a contractor. You know, a lot of employer cafeterias have contractors that run. We had one at work in the National Grid Building, not far from us. They have a cafeteria. It's run by a company called Lackey. There are a number of companies that do this. Sodexo is another one. And
you know, National Grid's building, but they hired Lackman to make the sandwiches. They don't know how to make sandwiches. They're in the power business, right? So, you know, Lackman does this, and Lackman has employees that make sandwiches and potholes and whatever else, right? Ordinarily, National Grid wouldn't have anything to do with how much Lackman is paying or how much Lackman is charging for a sandwich, right? But here, the employer retained control of the cost of the items in the cafeteria. That caused the court to find that it was a mandatory subject. In other words, the employee said, you know, the sandwiches are too expensive. Instead of charging $6.50 for a turkey sandwich, I want it to be $5.50. And they insisted they didn't pass on that. And the employer said, wait a minute, I don't, what are you asking me about that? I'm not bargaining about that with you. Oh, yes, you have to bargain about that with me. It's a mandatory subject. No, it's not. Yes, it is, because the employer retained control of the price. Okay? In the other hypothetical, where it's National Grid, and they don't have anything to do with what Lackman charges, I think that's permissible. If they don't retain control of that, you're asking me to control something I don't have control of. I don't know what they're charging for a sandwich, and I don't care. It's their deal, you know? It's not my thing. I'm not going to be forced to change contractors because you don't like the cost. I don't think that goes far enough to being a mandatory subject. Other examples. Drug testing. Drug testing for employees in the bargaining unit. The employer wants drug testing of those employees. Right? The union says, no way. Can the employer insist the impasse on it? Is it mandatory or permissive? That's mandatory, as you might think. It certainly affects employees' terms and conditions of employment. If they fail the drug test, they're probably going to get fired, okay? So certainly there's enough of a connection there such that you would find that to be mandatory, okay? Subcontracting, in a case called Fiberboard, where the employer wants a provision that permits it to subcontract certain work performed by people in the bargaining unit. You can't just do that. You've got to bargain with the union over that. That's a mandatory subject, okay? It's not permissive. So you start to understand what this mandatory really means. It's topics that are germane to the working environment. I'll leave you up with an example, one final one, that has caused the cause of much controversy, actually, at least in my view. How about a holiday bonus? Make it better. A Christmas turkey. Every year, the employer has given a turkey at the Christmas season, at the holiday season, to employees. It's not that uncommon. It's done in a lot of large companies, okay? And one year, the employer says, look, tells the union, I'm not doing that anymore. The union says, wait a minute, what do you mean you're not doing that anymore? That's a benefit. You've got to bargain with me before you're not doing it anymore. The employer says, I'm not bargaining with you. That's a perk. That's not a term and condition of employment. I'm doing it. The end. Refusing to bargain over a mandatory subject is as illegal as insisting to bargain over a permissive subject. Right? It's really mirror images of the same thing. Okay? Remember, you can't refuse to bargain over a mandatory subject. You can't insist to impasse on a permissive subject. In 2 minutes, do you think the Christmas curtains could be a mandatory subject? Yeah.
No.
You say no. Why?
Because I think it's more of a gift.
Of a gift.
Even if they deal with it correctly, it's like, happy holidays, here's your turkey.
Happy holidays, here's your turkey. Anybody want to be on the other side? Nobody?
If they've been doing it forever, then it's part of their payment for the holiday season, like a holiday bonus, which is built into the conditions of payment for the job done.
Okay. All right. Sean, you have something?
I was going to say, it seems kind of humane, in the working environment, if you're on holidays, so that's something they expect.
Oh, you're all kissing up and you see where I'm going here. It's okay if you disagree with me. I'm not angry with you. I'll tell you a funny story in a second. Adam, did you have something more? Okay, look. What if I try to put this into real terms, is what I would tell you. All of you who think that it's a permissive subject, okay? I'm an employee. I've worked at the company for 20 years. Every year I get a turkey at Christmas. I don't make a lot of money, okay? I live paycheck to paycheck, right? I don't put a lot away because I really can't. And every year at Christmas, I come to rely on the turkey because 12, 13, I don't know, how much is a turkey? Good turkey for feeding a big family. The upwards of 15, 20 bucks, right? I don't really have it. I'm used to that turkey. I rely on that turkey. I know I'm going to get it every year, right? And now, you're telling me you can't have it. Why is that not a term and condition of my employment? Why is it more of a gift when, after 20 years, I've come to rely upon it? I need that turkey now. Okay? Yeah?
It was never expected to provide it. It was just given as a birthday.
That may be. You gave it to me for 20 years, and now I'm relying on it. Does my reliance matter at all? Should it?
I think it's a case-by-case situation. If you're 20 years, if it's someone 2 years, that's different. It's a totality circumstance.
That's a fair point. That's a fair point. Yeah.
I don't really think the line should come into play. When you were looking at mental substance as well as a term of one, that seems to be something that would make or break your decision of accepting a job, you know, payment for work hours. And at the beginning of it, if you say, oh, holiday turkey, no holiday turkey, it's like, at that time, you're going to say, well, I really don't give to lose either way.
Well,
now since you come to rely on it, now all of a sudden it changes to a term.
Sure! Absolutely! Absolutely, because after 20 years of figuring out my economic circumstance all depends on what the union can get me as a wage rate, and I budgeted, my family budgeted in such a way that I've come to rely on that turkey. Listen, the act doesn't force the employer to give me the turkey. All they have to do is talk about it. Okay? They can't just do it. They can't just take it away without talking about it. Because once they talk about it, maybe if the union knows that I'm relying on that turkey and that I need that turkey, the union can offer something else as some sort of an accommodation, some sort of a bargain, if you will, so that I can keep my turkey. If enough people in that bargaining unit tell that union, I want that turkey and I need that turkey and I'm willing to give up something else, why can't the union have a chance to talk? Nobody's insisting the employer get the turkey. Just talk. It's a talking statue, okay? That's all it is. Just talk about it. I know I went over, but I'll go ahead.
Were you the answer?
No. The answer to the question is, the board has found that it is not. Yeah. The question is actually a bit uncertain. At one time, the board found it was mandatory. At another time, in a case called Benchmark Industries, they found that it was not. No, you do not. No, you do not. And the reason it comes to mind is because, first of all, it's a nice way to highlight this distinction between mandatory and just as you kind of get the idea here. But the reason it's fresh in my mind is that in collective bargaining down the hall in room 206 in 1995, I had a major debate with another individual over this topic. And unusual for law school, though we are teaching you to argue, it almost went too far. There was yelling, accusations, and of course, the professor loved everything. He was thoroughly and completely entertained by this screaming fight. As you can well imagine, I argued for the side that had said it was mandatory. This other individual argued for the permissive side. It's a teaching tool here. It's fresh in my memory from a point at which I nearly reached fisticuffs with another individual. Take that for what it's worth.
Jackson Lewis will tell the employer, give him a nice letter, wish him a happy holiday, to come enjoy the nice gift for the holiday, right? Tell him it's
Yeah, probably.
Right.
It would.
I suspect they would. Characterize it as a gift, spin it a little bit, in better shape. 100%? Right.